Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Mike Bank. Mike is the founder of Underdog, a pre-accelerating syndicate designed to support solo and non-traditional founders in launching revenue-generating businesses without needing to quit their day jobs. His career spans investment banking at Citi, early stage VC at Number One Seed, multiple ventures as a 2x VC-backed founder, and a prolific angel investor with around 100 early stage bets under his belt. Through roles at Antler, OneDay.io, and now Underdog, Mike has worked hands-on with hundreds of founders, helping them de-risk ideas, accelerate launch, and rethink what venture success can look like. In today's episode, we talked about whether 100 bets is a lot as an angel investor, negotiating a management buy-in at a service station on the way to Wales, how it's never been simpler to start a business, but that doesn't mean it's easy, and why you should think about your business through the lens of desirability, feasibility, and affordability.
Does anyone want what you've got to offer?
Whether venture capital is going back to its roots, and how Mike is accelerating a 13-year-old selling mystery seeds in a box at Underdog.
The youngest person that we've had on Underdog was 13 years old.
And why there is no special space for any of us, so let's remove those mental barriers when we think about diversity.
There's no special place for you. You're going to have to work fucking hard.
How mentoring over 100 day zero founders over a year led to launching Underdog.
I got invited to mentor on this, venture program, I suppose, but working with very early, as in like day zero founders, people who wanted to start something, but in many cases didn't know what they wanted to start.
And Mike's contrarian opinion, it's okay to fail even if it's not well accepted here in the UK, but success should also be celebrated. And inequality of life will always exist, and that's okay.
I think it is both okay to fail.
Let's get straight into it. Hey guys, whilst I've got you here for a second, I thought I'd reintroduce myself. My name's Arish. I'm the host of Nothing Ventured, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture ecosystem go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy providing fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from seed to Series B and beyond. If you like the podcast, we'd love it if you could rate and subscribe on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to tell me anything about what you've heard today or recommend any guests that you'd like for us to have on, reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Right, let's get back into it. Mike, really great to have you in the studio with me today. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. My pleasure to be here, Arish.
Amazing. Well, look, I wanted to start by talking a little bit about your angel kind of investing journey. So, you know, 100 bets plus is a pretty big number for most angels. What's the story behind your portfolio and kind of over what time frame did you build it up and what sort of patterns have you seen emerge? I'd also love to understand how you evaluate founders or ideas when, you know, especially at early stage, there's so little signal. And we've talked about that a huge amount. You know, we're on a couple of WhatsApp chats. We definitely talk about that a lot, right? So I know it is the big question that most angels have when they're getting into investing. And what do you wish more angels understood? I think there is, you know, there's this sort of assumption that all angels come into angel investing having had some background in venture investing or maybe even public equities. But in my experience, that's often not the case. So anyway, I know there's a bunch of questions there, but yeah, would love to get your take on the 100 bets. How did you build it? What sort of time frame? And what do you wish angels knew?
Yeah. So 100 bets sounds like a lot. Some of those, just for complete transparency, were via funds.
Got it.
It's in early stage funds. So I've been an LP, an investor in funds, and they deployed the capital. They kind of chose who to invest in.
Yeah.
But I've also been part of accelerator programs, not my own, where I was also an investor, an LP, but I sat on the investment committee.
Got it.
So we got to choose who we wanted to back, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Not all 100 direct myself, although it is possible, man. We know people. I'm thinking of certain people who have done way more than 100, you know, 500 plus.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Doug, right?
Yeah.
He's done an awful lot. And
also via funds as well as direct, as well as various other things. Yeah, yeah.
But multiples of what I've done. So yeah. 100 sounds like a lot. In reality, it's barely scratching the surface. And I think, I mean, look, if there is one thing that I would want aspiring angel investors to understand, it is that diversity is your friend when it comes to Well, I said diversity. By that, I mean a diverse portfolio, i.e. you want 100 minimum bets, I would suggest, in order to tap into the power law that basically dictates your returns when it comes to venture.
Yeah.
And we're used, I mean, look, in the real world, most things are a bell curve distribution, right?
Mm.
Like most things are somewhere in the middle and there were a few outliers. In venture, maybe 1-3% will absolutely outperform.
Mm-hmm.
And the vast majority will go to nothing.
So this is an interesting question, right? Because, or is an interesting point rather, right? Because when I think about angel investing, and I'm sure you think about it in the same way, because we're inherently sort of involved, embedded in the tech ecosystem, we both probably think about angel investing as specifically investing into kind of tech growth businesses. Mm. Whereas obviously business angels, traditional business angels in kind of the way the term evolved, invest in bricks and mortar and in coffee shops and in, you know, small shops and gyms and whatever it might be. So within your portfolio, do you have some of those, or have you decided only to kind of focus on the high growth side?
That's a good question. Yeah, actually a real mix for me. Obviously the vast majority have been what we would call tech businesses, I suppose, software businesses, but I've been a partner in the restaurant group as in like physical assets.
Yeah.
I've done consumer products as in like physical products,
yeah,
a whole range of stuff. And that's not just as an angel, but as an operator as well.
Yeah.
So there has been a mix, but I'm not even sure that that is really wise.
Yeah.
I mean, why I got into angel investing is I was at the investment bank working my butt off, right? You were a banker as well, maybe not investment banker.
I was back office, but yeah.
But man, flipping heck. I mean, we were doing, you know, 100, 120 hour weeks. Not every week, right? But at times, it was pretty intense.
Yeah, like this week would have been one of those weeks where you'd probably have been doing a fair amount, right?
Yeah, probably. Or just sent home, frankly. Like, who knows? Maybe wouldn't have had a job. Yeah, and I started in, well, originally 06 and then took some time out and then came back in 07 full time, which was peak, right? That was like crazy deals happening left, right, and center. Incredible experience and a baptism of fire in many respects. But then
Lehman.
2008 came away. Yeah. Lehman, Bear Stearns. And those were miserable years. And I'm not sure I'd want to live through those again. And I kind of feel like we just came, I mean, like...
We came close.
Yeah. Well, who knows? I mean, it's still ongoing, right?
Yeah.
So, look, I wouldn't want to be back there now. But at the time, I was quite enjoying it. But the caliber of the people that you work with, almost in any industry, in any job, in any role, in any team, that is going to impact your ability to enjoy your job, which directly impacts your ability to do well, right?
Yeah.
And that fell away for me a little bit.
Yeah.
I basically had two bosses.
I think I wrote yesterday about toxic traits and like just having learned over 20 years to just avoid the living shit out, like just avoid them.
Look, and you've got all of us to a large degree, we've got autonomy, right? We've got the ability to say yes or no to different opportunities put in front of us.
Yeah.
Now, granted, some people have got to work. Like, you've got to be there. You've got to find another job before you quit.
Yeah.
I, luckily enough, didn't. You know, we were paid pretty well, I'll be honest. And we didn't have much of a life, right? If you're working 80, 100 hour weeks.
But you're not the greatest investor in the world, right? Like, you're not Gary.
So we overlap. I don't know him and I didn't know him, but we overlapped at university and later at Citigroup. We were there at the same time, basically. Definitely wasn't the greatest investor in the world. Not convinced that he was the highest paid investor in the world either.
Yeah.
And there's a good FT article which kind of bashes through the myths on him specifically. But yeah, look, I make no great claims, right? And I'm 41 now. I'm no spring chicken. But I still feel like a kid in some respects because I'm still figuring out what I'm good at and what I enjoy. And I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
I'm still figuring it out.
So we kind of, so you were talking about how you got into angel investing. So was it post-investment banking? You're like, I like investing, don't like IB. This angel stuff looks interesting. Or like, how did you make that sort of jump?
It was a bit more circuitous than that. So what I found happening somewhat naturally, but also because I made it happen, going back to that autonomy and the ability to choose who you work with, I found myself naturally gravitating towards the more entrepreneurial clients in the bank. Mm. And these were the owner-operated businesses, often private equity-backed, so maybe they only had a sliver of equity left, but the people running these companies were the ones who'd originally set them up 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And that was powerful to me. I was like, wow. Yeah.
And if they only had a sliver left, hopefully they would have already taken their liquidity and cashed out, right?
Like a lot of them had cashed out. Some of them actually had reinvested back into the businesses. There was one that we did work with. In fact, it was my first big deal. Mm. Basically landed there and got handed this deal. Mm. And I was working directly with one of the senior managing directors on it. There wasn't much cover, basically. It was me and him, which was incredible. I was like, wow, this is amazing. And I learned a lot on that deal. But that was with a team of guys who had set up a debt collection agency.
Yeah.
And it was 2008, remember? And we were trying to flog it on behalf of the private equity company that owned it. Mm.
That's a good transaction to be involved in.
Yeah.
In 2008.
It didn't sell in the end, actually. The owner said, no, we're not happy with that bid or with the bids that we got them. And they held on to it for better or worse, probably for worse, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
But the people who had set that up were still the guys running it. Mm. And yeah, this was going to be a transformational transaction for them. Mm. They were going to fully exit. They were going to leave it to the new owners. And they'd already planned what they were going to spend their millions on, right? Which was pretty cool.
Mm. And that pushed you into angel, like, oh, that's how you kind of moved into, or is that where your love, I guess that's where your love for entrepreneurial businesses came from.
Yeah, I mean, I come from a family of entrepreneurs, certainly on my dad's side, right? So my granddad had his own business, which he set up from scratch. He was a tailor, essentially, and he ended up, struggles to think what the equivalent would be today. And he certainly wasn't like an enormous multi-billionaire or anything like that, but he had a great business that he built up, he sold. He retired when my dad was 10 years old.
Oh, wow.
Which is crazy.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And yeah, just speaking with him before he passed away when I was a kid, and I was like, wow, this is kind of in my blood in some respects.
Yeah.
And my plan had always been to spend 1 year in investment banking, tick it off on the CV.
Yeah.
And then because of 2008 and the great financial crash, I just wasn't getting access to the type of stuff that I thought would be helpful to me. So I stuck around, and there were cool people who I was working with. You know, for the first time ever, I felt like probably the stupidest person in the room, which is a good place to be in some respects, right? Yeah.
Built my career around it.
Like, don't worry.
Just continue to be the stupidest person in the room. Well, it's fine.
Not today, my friend, not today.
No, I think it's okay. You talked about the bell curve. We're probably somewhere sat in the middle.
I'm sure. I think so, sadly. Yeah, unlike some of these other people who are 160 plus.
Yeah.
So ChatGPT tells.
Apparently,
yeah. If you believe. So yeah, look, I'm probably like of average intelligence. I'm not a particularly hard worker, even though I can put in the hours, right? I've proven that. And that was part of the baptism of fire was, can I do this physically, mentally? Can I put myself through it? And I know I can, but I don't think that is the way to live life.
Mm.
And I think work-life balance is important. So that definitely factored into my decision to leave.
Mm.
But why I ended up doing what I was doing was because, yeah, I like the entrepreneurial guys. And I thought I'd love to be doing this type of stuff, but on my own account.
Yeah.
So even before quitting, I was working on a side deal.
Got it.
Tiny little, I guess you would call it a management buy-in type of thing, where there was a retiring business owner, not a big business, small business, retiring owner. His second in command was like, yeah, I wanted to take it over, but I don't have the money. And he put out a call to investors to say, who would like to back me to do this? So we kind of met up really randomly. I drove to some service station in the middle of nowhere because his business was based in the middle of Wales or something like that. So I drove up to the service station. It looked like a drug deal or something, right? This like young whippersnapper kid, which was me at the time, and this old dude kind of shaking hands and, you know, passing files over to each other. And we pulled together this really, you know, what I thought was a really complex, really smart deal, full of jargon and stuff. And we submitted it. And unsurprisingly, perhaps, we lost the deal. And the owner, even though he knew this guy and trusted him, he was bamboozled by, frankly, what I'd pulled together.
Right.
And he just went with another bid. And it just got me thinking that, one, I'm probably not as smart as I'm making myself out to be, right? And simplicity is king. But secondly, it just got me geared up. I was like, okay, that one fell through. I could have gone, okay, back to investment banking, done and dusted. No way. I was like, I need to be doing this full time.
Well, that would have been the wrong lesson to learn, right? Like as in, and especially angel investing, to your earlier point, 90% of them are going to go to zero, right? Like, you know, I know loads of people that are kind of doing mini private equity transactions at the moment. Like the point again is that even those which are more secure deals, right? Because in the private equity space, you're talking about EBITDA generative businesses, like they have cash flows, they're by very definition, private equity backed businesses are much more likely to be stable and growing slower, et cetera, compared to venture, let's say. Yeah. But you got to kiss a lot of frog. Like you will get into lots of deals that you'd love to execute on that you can't, and you'll get into lots of deals that you don't want to execute in, but you got to look at them before you can make that decision, right? Like, and I think, you know, I'm a strong believer in this, that, you know, one of the biggest problems in I talk about this way too much as well, but like in our education system is it's kind of fear of failure.
Oh yeah.
Right. And certainly coming through private education in the UK where you are, you know, you are told you're the best of the best and, you know, you pass every exam, you know, with A's and 80%, 90%, whatever marks. But the minute, you know, you come across actual difficulty, I've seen so many of my peers just not be able to cope with that. I'm not saying all of them for sure. Like there are, you know, clearly some very, very smart people that come through the private education system as well. But if we gave people a taste of what failure looks like and how to embrace it and leverage it, I think we'd have a much better situation just generally and globally and certainly here in the UK than we otherwise do. And it goes back to, I mean, like we're joking about Gary, and like for those that don't know, I'm not going to explain it, but you know, Gary's been a meme for the last 2 weeks. But his whole shtick is like, you don't have agency, you're going to remain poor, like suffer.
Sure.
Right. I think you and I come from the school of, no, you have agency. You can, you know, you can try. Doesn't mean you're going to succeed every time. Doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to be a massive stonking success. Doesn't mean you're going to make millions. But if you don't shoot your shot, you're never going to know. Right.
I mean, what I find interesting about Gary is the fact that he is exactly of the demographic that he's saying doesn't have agency, and yet he has managed to succeed.
Yeah.
So he's the counterexample to what he's...
I'm the last person that's ever going to be successful.
It's just nonsense, in my opinion. Yeah, and I think it's counterproductive. I mean, look, he's probably far smarter than I am and can probably...
Does not sound it.
Well, yeah, but again, we come from different worlds, right? I know our backgrounds are both equally crazy in different measures, but we come from broadly similar backgrounds. We're at similar places in life with some differences, right? Mm. But ultimately, I think we're probably more similar to each other than either of us is to someone like Gary. I guess what annoys me about his message is it's that sort of resignation that, no, you don't have agency, you're stuffed, the world's against you, you have no power to change that. Yeah. And I've actually built my life, my career, everything about who I am today around the belief that actually we do have maybe not complete agency, right? I can't jump and land on the moon. I'm not saying that. Yeah. But I think this acceptance of where you are at in life and almost the... I mean, this is where Underdog came from, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, feels like this... The story is the story of Underdog to an extent, right?
And perhaps that's why I'm so like viscerally frustrated by the message that Gary puts out there, which is, no, look, your stuff, the world's against you. You can't make any, you can't change your circumstance. Actually, every single cohort that we have run with Underdog, people have been doing exactly that.
Yeah. It's that scarcity mindset, right? I think, look, those of us that have had or taken a more entrepreneurial path, I think it's equally easy for us to say it because we've done it, right? And we know that we do have agency. But, you know, as I'm sure has happened with you, like I've had a failed business, I've had failed investments, I've had failed whatever, right?
Yeah, way more than successes in my case.
Yeah, for sure. And even like even today, you know, whilst I hope, pray, and try my damnedest to make sure it is a success, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in a year's time. Like my business could not be doing what I want it to do or whatever, right? Like, but the point is, and again, I think it's this whole thing about if you don't attempt, you don't know. And if you don't fall over, you don't know what to change, right? Like I know now, having not been able to build the tech business that I wanted to build, I know how I would do it today, right? And I'm doing things of the nature of what I learned what I would do, right? Which is literally not going out, not raising money, figuring out, okay, how do I strap this together with as little money as possible, see if something works, and then, okay, fine. If that then becomes something, that's a different matter. But building for the problem rather than trying to build a solution that no one else needs, which is a roundabout way of saying, like, I think everyone has agency. I think the biggest determinant or one of the biggest factors that works against people, and certainly in this country, right, it is not having any kind of safety net behind them, which allows them to take the risk in the first place, right? And I think that's the reality, right? I know for a fact if everything went to crap, if I, like, you know, was not able to work tomorrow, or, clients basically decided they didn't want to work with us, even if I couldn't pay my mortgage, I could go and crash on my parents' couch, right? And or my parents and my uncles and my sister and whatever, there would be room for me and my family to get ourselves back on our feet if that were needed. The problem for most people is they just don't have that. Like, even risking, I say even, like, many people don't even have £5,000 to risk, but let's say even risking 5,000 would be a huge consideration for many people. So, you know, I've always thought about, well, the way I've thought about my business is, has always been like, if I'm not risking something personal, then, like, I'm doing a disservice. I.e., like, I don't want to just take investors' cash and burn through that. And you can take risk in different ways. So there can be capital risk, or you risk your money, but you know, risking your time, right? Which is essentially what you and I both do, right?
Absolutely.
Because neither of us know what the payoff's going to be. It's quite depressing for a Friday afternoon, but it is reality, right? Neither of us know what the payoff is going to be with whatever activities we're doing today, but we have faith and work towards those outcomes kind of happening.
I'll say two things off the back of that. Firstly, let's try and not get you cancelled today.
Yeah,
that's number one.
It's
right?
All right. Well, I don't know. If I get cancelled, maybe I can grow further. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Well, you'll bounce back. But again, that's the point, right? And yes, look, was starting my own business the first thing that I did? No.
Yeah.
I actually got myself a safety net. And same as you, right? I've got friends, family. I actually did some mentoring for a long time with a homelessness charity, helping people who have been previously homeless back into employment.
Yeah.
Because what happens is when you lose your home, you lose your social network, your circle. There's often substance abuse issues related to that. And you lose the trust of those closest to you. And often, from their mouths, not mine, the biggest issue is that you have let people down so often that they're not willing to give you a chance.
Yeah.
But the fascinating thing for me is, in the training for that mentoring, you're going back 15 years or something now, they said, who here has been homeless before? I was looking around the room and I was like, well, none of us, right?
Yeah.
And they went, well, actually, being homeless means that you didn't have a fixed abode. Has any of you, like, done couch surfing before? Have you, like...
Have you been a digital nomad, whatever?
Or whatever. And I hadn't been back then, but I had. It's going to sound ridiculous, right? I come back from a ski season, right? And I didn't have a home.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you know what I was able to do? Yeah, I could have crashed at my parents, for sure. But even if they weren't there, and what I did end up doing is crashing at friends' houses. I was like, oh, yeah, I've not got a place yet. Can I crash on your couch for, like, a couple of days, or in your spare room?
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. Okay, granted, I'm not saying I've been homeless and living on the streets. No, I haven't.
Yeah.
But I recognize, I suppose, my privilege to a certain extent, right? Yeah. I had, even though it wasn't necessary for me, I could have just gone and rented a place, right? Or Airbnb probably didn't exist back then. But I had that social network. And I thought, wow, holy smokes. If you have nothing, how can you ever get to even the starting line, right?
Yeah.
You can't get to the starting line.
Yeah. Just as you were saying that, I was thinking about the Will Smith film. In Search of Happiness?
In Search of Happiness, I think
it's
called.
In Search of Happiness?
Something like that, yeah.
That sort of thing, right? And which is based off a true story. Homeless guy with a kid on the streets gets into investment banking. But, like, it's a very powerful movie because everything was against him. And yet, because he exercised his agency, right? Like, again, but to your point, if you don't have that network, if you don't have even that starting point of someone that's willing to say, look, crash on the couch for a month, you know,
yeah,
get yourself sorted, figure stuff out, how do you then take the next step after that?
And look, I've paid that forwards many times. I've had people crashing on my couches when they've needed to. Mm. So I think, yeah, paying it forwards and having almost building an ecosystem around you is important. Mm. But there's kind of two ways of looking at it, right? Which is, yeah, absolutely. Some people do need to be given a little push or a pull up in the right direction to get to that starting line.
Sure.
Yes, not everyone is lucky enough, like certainly I am, and it sounds like you are too, to have that safety net. That's absolutely fine. But it is a fallacy in my mind, and this is what we have built Underdog around, to think that you need to risk everything in order to start. And actually, the smartest founders will do one of two things, and you alluded to one of the parts already, which is they will risk other people's money, time, etc. So I'm thinking, okay, to be controversial or not, again, someone like Adam Newman.
Yeah.
Yes, was he a hustler? Yes, did he risk a lot personally, for sure. But actually, I don't know. Look, I don't know him.
Yeah.
I've read a few books and watched the Apple TV series on him, right? Yeah. So that's what I'm basing this on. But then he, you know, when he really bet the house, it wasn't his house he was betting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one path, right? You convince other people, which again comes back to ecosystem, networking, building trust.
And again, you and I both know this, and we've talked about this, and we're on chats where this conversation happens again and again. The problem and the argument that a lot of people would give is if they don't have access to those networks, and often see those networks as being relatively closed doors and closed off to them, then how do they take that next step? And my answer to that is, well, if you are building something, whether it's a product, whether it's service, whatever, your assumption shouldn't be that someone should fund me day one. It should be prove why someone should fund me. Those doors will open. And you know, again, in this day and age, like, it's interesting. Last weekend, random story, last weekend, I was sat quite annoyed and bored at Urban Outfitters whilst my daughter was looking for some clothes. I'd been railroaded in to go. I thought we were going for boba tea with my wife and my daughter.
It was a bait and switch, basically.
Yeah, it was a bait and switch. Yeah. We ended up, you know, Urban Outfitters or whatever. Although she would say, well, you were really, you know, grumpy the whole time. Anyway, fine. I'm on Twitter. I'm like toing and froing with Anand Sanwal, who is the founder of CB Insights. Like, he's building something in education, like a new education kind of curriculum system, etc. And I was like, you know, responding to something he said, and I said, look, I'd love to get you on the podcast to talk about this. Put the phone down, picked it up again after about 10 minutes. And I'm like, oh shit. He's like responded with his email address.
Oh, nice.
And I've been in touch, and he's going to come on the podcast at some point. Might be a while, but you know, it'll happen. But my point is, like, in a day where the internet exists, your ability to get in front of people is 100x what it was even 10 years ago. Like, you can shoot your shot and find that person, whether it is the buyer, whether it is the investor, whether it is the employee, whether it is whatever, you can find whoever you want on the internet, and you can at least try and get in front of them. Doesn't always mean you will, but if you are compelling, if you have a story that is convincing and compelling enough, it can happen, right?
Yeah, look, I would say it's never been simpler to start a business.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make it easy.
Yeah, oh, of course.
Still difficult, right? I think what many people do wrong is they never try.
Yeah.
And so Tim Ferriss, have you heard of him?
Yeah, 4 Hour Work Week.
A lot of people haven't heard of him. But yeah, I read it. I think the 4 Hour Work Week came out in 2007.
Yeah.
And I bought it when it came out and read it, not every night, right?
Yeah.
But it was sat on my desk. Maybe it wasn't the smartest move, right, to put it right there. But it was a physical book, sat there, and it inspired me to a large degree. Mm. And actually, he's the reason that I started angel investing rather than going down the, what do they call it now? The what used to be called the search fund, and they're now called ETA, I think, entrepreneurship through acquisition.
Yeah, so search funds were like people would basically stake whatever the number is, 100 million, a couple of guys would go out, try and find a business that was worth acquiring, and then that would be spacked up and basically, yeah.
Yeah, that was like the extreme end. But the smaller, I mean, how it first started was out of Stanford, I believe.
Right.
And it was like maybe one professor who had a couple of MBA students, and he thought, yeah, they're going to go somewhere. Let me, together with a syndicate of my friends, essentially pay
back them.
Yeah. I'll just pay them a small salary.
Yeah.
Well, probably not small in real terms, but small compared to what they could get elsewhere. A small salary to go and find the company and convince the owner to sell it to them. When they convince the owner to sell it to them, we will then, me and my friends,
invest in that.
And it needn't be 100 million.
Yeah.
We needn't, you know, spack it up, I think you said. Yeah,
spack it up.
If you can say that these days. That would have been, that was the path I was sort of going on, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was basically what I'd done with that crazy guy that I met in the service station in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
That would have been what they now call entrepreneurship through acquisition.
Yeah.
I don't think that would have been smart for me. I mean, I wouldn't have been embedded as an owner-operator.
Yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't have made the mistake that a lot of these MBA students do make, which is to think, I know it all.
I can do it.
I can apply this. I mean, it's super tough. The problem there is all your eggs are in one basket.
Yeah.
If you're the owner-operator, if you're the owner, great. If you're the owner-operator, it is incredibly hard to split your time.
Yeah.
So back then, and he's stopped talking about it now, probably for good reason, but Tim Ferriss was talking about the real world MBA.
Right.
And that was the concept of taking your business school money and instead of paying it to Harvard or Stanford or whatever, investing it hands-on into startups and trying to build your network, your experience, your skill set. And to a certain degree, if you did well, your resources, right? Because you would get a return. So that's what I did. But his view was take that capital as a sunk cost.
Yeah.
Do not expect to get it back in the same way as if you spent it on education.
No, so I'm a strong believer in that methodology of learning, right? So there's a couple of things. So investing is a great way to learn because, you know, nothing teaches you more than losing your money or making money. But equally, you know, a lot of people say that I've heard a lot of founders say this, and I kind of I'm very uncomfortable with this as a philosophy, I think is the right word I'd use. Although I have also heard investors say this, which is when you raise money for your own business, you are learning on someone else's dime, right? And that's okay. My problem with it is like I don't like being beholden, I learned that I don't like being beholden to other people, and I'm very uncomfortable learning on someone else's dime. but yes, that kind of
look, we're similar in that regard, which is
the Thiel thought process as well, right? Like don't go to university. Here's a grant, and we know a couple of people that are doing similar stuff as well. I want to move on.
Let me say one more thing.
Yeah,
which is super, super, super important.
Yeah.
So I talked about the two different paths, and we covered one, which is
basically
learn on someone else's dime.
Yeah.
I think there is a second path, which is completely overlooked, and that embodies what we do at Underdog.
Yeah.
Which is do not risk it all.
Yeah.
And actually, if you think about a traditional accelerator.
Yeah.
You've got to apply and have a great CV for a start. So you're probably not going to get in if you come from a background that we actually look for and love.
Mm.
So you're not even going to pass the paper sift.
Mm.
But even if you do pass the paper sift, you've then got to be willing to relocate potentially.
Mm.
Let's say you're based in Newcastle.
Mm.
You have to relocate to London.
Mm.
And then you've got to work basically for free for 3 months for someone else in person. Maybe leave your kids behind, your family behind. That is a massive risk.
That's the more kind of incubator, like very, very, like as opposed
early
to say,
stage.
Yeah.
But even YC, right? If you get into Y Combinator, probably the preeminent accelerator in the world, incredible track record, they're going to require you to be there in 100%. Person.
Yeah. Although I think that's changed a little bit. I think there is now some online, like, because I think they broadened the application.
I think they brought it back during COVID. But, you know, either way, like most investors then, okay, even taking that away, if you go and raise investment for your company and you're able to do so, great, they're going to require you probably to work full time on that.
Oh, of course.
And there will be carve outs.
Yeah.
I mean, we say, of course, for my first venture backed company, we had like multiple pages of carve outs of all the other stuff that we could do, right?
Yeah.
Because we
you were savvy
portfolio.
Enough. To, yeah.
Well, yeah. One, I wasn't savvy enough. Well, I was partnered with two people who were.
Okay.
Which was really good. So yeah, I guess I was learning from them. But I suppose the point I'm making is, yes, do not. It's great if the world is given to you on the platter. Fantastic, right? Everything you need is there. Great, fantastic. rather than tearing those people down, though, and saying, oh, woe betide me, I haven't got the silver platter or the silver spoon shoved up my backside. Forget about that and actually hustle.
Yeah.
And figure out how much can you do without putting too much at risk. And we've had people on Underdog who have launched revenue-generating businesses in under 10 weeks, in some cases generating revenue in week one, by the way, simply because, not because we're not an accelerator, really. I know you described us as that. We used to describe ourselves as an accelerator. I don't anymore. And I've not come up with a better term, though. But we don't accelerate people. We just take off the handbrake. We say, guys, all of these excuses that you have been making, throw them out the window. I don't have any money. Okay, so what? Pick up the phone, go and meet someone, go and try and sell them something. I don't have a product or service to sell them. Who cares? First, see if you can actually sell it. Do they want what it is that you've got to offer? And once we take away all of these kind of false
they're barriers. Constraints. They're like, they are mental constraints. Yeah, exactly.
And it is in the head.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them are real constraints, right? If you are trying to build a rocket ship to Mars.
Yeah, you need cash.
Okay. And we talk about, I mean, very often we talk about the startup triangle of success. And top of that is desirability. Does anyone want what you've got to offer?
Yeah.
If they don't, you're stuffed.
Yeah.
But, you know, I could say, Arish, would you like to teleport back home tonight in a split second? You'd probably go, yeah, of course. Yeah. But then feasibility, can I actually make that happen?
Yeah.
If I can't, okay, I haven't got a business either, right? But if I could, but it costs £200 billion to do that, you ain't going to pay me. So financial viability, i.e. can I make money by selling it to you? Okay. Yeah. So those are the three factors, but people forget about the top one, desirability.
Yeah.
Like the biggest problem that we see is people, and the analogy I use is they make this really intricate key. They've come up with this great idea. They craft this beautiful key out of solid gold with gemstones around it. And then they go, wow, I've spent my life's, I mean, literally this has happened, not with an actual key, right, but with businesses. I've had founders coming to me going, I spent 7 years of my life and all of my life savings building this product.
Yeah.
And they built the key, basically.
Yeah.
And now they come to me and they go, can you help me find the lock that it opens?
Yeah.
I'm like, guys, you screwed up a long time ago.
Yeah.
You should have found the lock first. And then you wouldn't have even needed the key. You could have bashed it open with a hammer.
Yeah.
Initially, right?
Yeah,
and then you find more locks.
It's the age old, like, don't build the solution, tackle the problem, like, sort of thing, right? And the problem is most people, myself included, right, will default to, oh, I can build something cool that is a solution without actually figuring out what the problem was in the first place, right?
So, and it's an age, an age old issue.
Yeah. I think this kind of segs quite well into my next sort of topic that I want to talk to you about, right? Because you and I have spoken about this new way of building businesses, and I'd love to understand what that means for you, right? So, you know, sort of taking things forward from what you just discussed, do you think we're finally seeing a break from this kind of VC-fueled hot potato game of raise, grow, raise again, raise more, fail, raise, whatever? So, you know, what does a capital-efficient one-and-done startup look like in practice today? And do you think this shift is founder-driven, market investor-driven, or just a correction from kind of the madness we were seeing a few years ago?
I think what we're getting back to, and before we even talk about the one-and-done rounds and, the one-person, billion-dollar businesses or whatnot, which I truly believe will exist if they don't already.
Yeah.
I think what we are seeing is venture, as in venture capital, going back to its roots.
Yeah.
I.e., being in, like, capital being invested into pioneering ideas that require that money in order to get off the ground.
R&D intensive businesses.
We're going to see a massive hike. Yeah, Nikki from the WhatsApp group is doing a lot of work with university spin outs. There's a technical term for it, which, you know, I don't know if you know it.
I call them university spin outs.
university spin outs, basically, you know, really.
Tech transfer is what it's called.
Yeah,
I think.
Tech transfer. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I knew.
Well, I had someone on the podcast literally spend an entire episode talking about it. So I should have remembered that sooner. But yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot of that.
So I think that type of stuff, and, you know, Silicon Valley is called Silicon Valley because VC basically funded the silicon chip development, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's going back to that, which is where it should sit. That is the right allocation of the capital in the asset class.
So the interesting thing there, right, and I, again, this is there is a contrarian view, right? Like, so if you talk to someone like me, I would 100% agree with you, right? Venture is reverting to not funding a better spreadsheet and a bit of B2B SaaS. It is looking at, okay, how do we develop better security in our defense or in our supply chain, or, you know, how do we build drugs that are more accessible or cheaper? How do we, you know, we're talking to one business, you know, that is building drugs in space. Like, there's some interesting stuff out there, right? Like, okay, these are all, you know, R&D intensive, going to take 7-10 years to commercialize kind of businesses. Like, yeah. I mean, again, that can vary, whatever, right? But a lot of med tech, life sciences, deep tech, material sciences, all those sort of businesses,
yeah.
Defense, right?
Defense tech, massive at the moment, yeah.
100%. And obviously what we're seeing, again, you know, what we're seeing in the markets, and, you know, we're recording this just after Liberation Day. So, you know, we're seeing the impact and, you know, the galvanization, I guess, of Europe and other global players saying, maybe we need to take care of ourselves a little bit, which obviously is going to flood, you know, flood funding into lots of these sort of areas. But my point is that if you were to take the optimistic view, which I think you and I would, venture is flowing into that. The pessimistic or the skeptical view is venture is flowing into that because it just allows VCs to defer DPI down the track, right? Because these businesses are going to take a lot longer to mature and materialize and exit.
Look,
but
players are going to play the game, right? Yeah. And VC, I think, at least in recent times, has become an AUM game, i.e. assets under management, i.e.
management fees.
The more money I can manage, the more I can draw down in a tiny sliver of fees. It's not become a performance game.
Yeah.
Or it's reverted away from becoming a performance game. And actually, there are plenty of, we'll be controversial again.
Why not?
There are plenty of SEIS funds and EIS funds, the tax schemes that, you know, I've taken advantage of both as a founder and as an investor, not against them at all. But I think there are certain funds who don't care whether or not.
Well, the incentivization is completely different, right?
They're incentivized to take capital and to deploy it, and they don't care whether or not the company succeeds or not. That's the reality. Yeah. And that makes me sad. And that is a bastardization. Is that a swear word? Never mind. A bastardization of venture.
Yeah.
That's not what venture should be, and that's not what it should be used for.
Yeah.
And that frustrates me. It doesn't make me angry, right? I'm not going to start tearing up the studio or anything like that, Arish, right?
Yeah.
We're safe. But it does frustrate me. And and the reason that frustrates me, what is the engineer?
Producer's just like stood up and go, what?
I said, I'm not going to start doing that. Relax. You can sit back down. We're safe. But I think what it does do is number one, it gives venture capitalists a bad name to a certain degree, which isn't great for me because I used to be one, and one day I think I would like to be one again.
Mm.
So that frustrates me. And secondly, I think it, because the incentives are misaligned, two things happen. Firstly, naive founders or unprepared founders or first-time founders can take venture capital money and they can be screwed over because the incentives are not aligned.
Yeah.
In theory, you know, the VCs will say, yeah, of course we're aligned. We all want you to do well. But actually doing well for them might not be the same path as doing well for you.
Mm.
So that's number one. Secondly, I think the industry as a whole, and the reason we see so many founders going, well, you know, all the time I get people coming up to me and going, oh, I've got a great idea, Mike.
If only I could find some money to just need
200 grand to build the app. Yeah. And I'm like, no, that is not what you need.
Yeah.
But they have been sold that lie by the industry because the industry is incentivized to get loads of money and to deploy it into junk businesses.
Yeah.
Now, okay, maybe I'm being overly simplistic, and of course it's not every VC, right? But I think we know what we know.
Yeah.
Enough of the players, right?
Yeah.
To confidently say that has been the case.
Yeah.
So I think for whatever the reason is, the move away from the old days of, so Uber, when Uber first launched in the UK, I was one of their first customers. I think I was customer 47 or something like that. Because this guy, Stephen Graham, had tweeted, Twitter, right?
Yeah.
He'd like tweeted about
Stephen Graham.
Do you? Yeah. I forget what he's building now.
Couldn't tell you, but yeah. Okay.
Teller or something, some sort of open banking fintech. I think he's moved to Silicon Valley or Austin, Texas or something. Yeah, really cool guy. I like met him in person a couple of times, right? I think he was, and this is about serendipity, which is also important. When I first started angel investing, I first like went into the wild and did the Tim Ferriss Real World MBA. I was going to every single flipping startup event possible. I was putting myself out there, just immersing myself in this. And Stephen Graham was, he was working for Twilio at the time. And he was like, crazy techie guy, and he was like, right, I'm gonna live code something in front of the audience. And he was doing it, and I had no idea what he was doing because I'm not technical, but I was like, man, he seems interesting. He's charismatic, he's full of personality, let me follow him on Twitter. And then he tweeted something about, oh, I'm in a blacked out S-Class Mercedes being driven back from this startup event. So I was like, just replied to him, what the heck's that? And he went, oh, it's this thing called Uber, use my code. And he must have been one of the first people because they were there at the event handing out codes, basically. So I became, I don't know, number 47 in the UK. I got free Ubers for basically a year. I had my own personal driver, essentially. This guy called Darren. I'm not joking, man. I was, and talking about couch surfing, my mate, this is going to, again, sound ridiculous. My mate had quit his job, gone traveling around the world. And he said, oh, do you want to look after my place in Pimlico whilst I'm away? You'll be doing me a favor. You can live there rent free. So yeah, okay. No worries.
Free house, free car.
Matt, and then Darren, the Uber driver, he was my guy, basically. He'd go, look, whenever you want an Uber, just text me and I'll make sure I come to you, basically. And then when you ask for an Uber, I'll just accept
it. The good old days when VCs could fund your lifestyle.
But that's my point, right? VCs were funding that lifestyle.
The same thing was happening with the 15-minute grocery delivery, right? Like, that's, that was the only reason they were viable.
Yeah, I didn't help set one up, but I was in very early conversations with a solo founder back in 2019 who was looking at setting one of these up. And we met, not loads of times, right? Like 4 or 5 times, and brainstormed, and he was building the business plan. And I'd just come out of Antler, another startup accelerator. And I was a bit jaded, actually, off the back of that experience. Some great stuff, but also some not great stuff. And I kind of already at that stage gone back to, let's prove before we go and fundraise. Let's get as far down the proof path as possible to de-risk things for investors. And also, probably like you, I don't want to be beholden to others if I can avoid it. So I said to him, look, let's, you know, I'll put some money in, you put some money in, let's set up a little, like a tiny unit. We'll hire a couple of scooters and we'll do the deliveries ourselves, right? That to me was like really cool. And he looked at me like I was weird and he was like, no, mate, I'll just go and raise £1 million with this pitch deck. And I was like, will you? Okay, cool, man, go do it. Literally did it. Just did the rounds and got £1 million off the back of a pitch deck. And I was like, kudos, man, crack on. Yeah. You don't need me, my friend. You do not need me.
Well, depends on what the outcome was, but yeah.
He then raised another £20 million off the back of that and then sold to one of the bigger players.
Yeah.
But again, talking
Weezy
about...
or whoever, yeah.
That was Weezy.
Okay, yeah, now I'm with you.
yeah, that was his business. I think they sold to the Gorillas or something.
Yeah, that's right, okay, fine.
So yeah, like, kudos to him, amazing. I think I messaged him to say congrats for the exit, but I didn't really want to ask. But my guess would be probably wasn't the best result for the founders, or certainly, even if they did well as the founders.
The investors wouldn't have, yeah.
Or the founding team, importantly, right? Yeah. The investors, whatever, right? That's the risk that we take. But, you know, like, money is fungible. They'll make more money elsewhere, right? With that power law, the time that they invested in that you can never recover.
Yeah, for sure.
And, yeah, look, all that to say, I had friends who were, and I wouldn't do it because I knew the guy. I was like, I'm not going to do it. But they were getting all the discount codes and stuff, and they were buying bottles of Bollinger and... I think they were being paid basically to drink Bollinger is what it amounted to. It was ridiculous. You put some money in, they give you more money back than you put in, and then they convert that to credits and get free champagne. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it was exactly the same in 2012 with Uber. So I always say Benchmark Capital, thank you very much. Thank you, Benchmark. I had a show for Darren and an S-Class Mercedes for free for a year, basically. But that's not what venture should be used for. And instead, look, can venture be used for that purpose, i.e. to accept, like, essentially to buy friends is what I call it.
Yeah.
If you give me $1 billion, yeah, man, I will be able to get millions of friends. I'll just give them money. Are they going to stick around when times are tight?
Yeah, it's the usual, like, you shouldn't be acquiring customers, you should be trying to figure out how to retain them, right?
But I'm not saying that's a bad business model. Mm. It clearly has worked, right? It's failed a lot of the time, but it has worked. Mm. But is there another path? Is there another route? And again, I come back to what we at Underdog call the 4+1 of your network or connections, your experience in the world, mm. the skill set that you have, and the resources you have available to you.
Mm.
That's the important one. Plus, the plus one is your reputation in the market.
Yep.
If you've got a good reputation, you can maybe get some of this from others. You get people with experience or with the skill set that you need. You can get capital if that's the resource that you're missing, for sure. But if you are only reliant on those four, and again, you're trying to build a rocket ship to Mars, I think we talked about it briefly before the pod, right? I did invest in a startup that is building a rocket ship to fire an umbrella into space to shield us from the sun's rays, right? I don't know if they're going
to succeed. We're going to have to talk about that separately, but yeah, okay.
But my point is, like, if you would come to me, Arish, and you've gone, yeah, this is what I'm building. Do you want to invest some money into this wacky project? I'd have probably been like, mate, probably not. I like you, but not really.
Mm.
These guys were former SpaceX engineers. They had a great team. So they had experience, skill set, and they were backed by some big VCs, which validated it somewhat for me.
Yeah.
And I thought, what a cool story to tell. One day I'll be on Arish's podcast. I'll be able to say that I invested in a rocket ship startup. Literally a moonshot in this case.
Sunshot, but yeah, okay.
Well, a sunshot. Or, yeah, hopefully it won't be like Icarus. They won't crash and burn. But we'll see. Who knows? Who knows? But I guess my point is something like that does require a lot of capital, but they were able to get that capital because of the other bits that they had. So they were missing the resources piece, but they were able to acquire that.
Yeah.
But I think it is a fallacy to say that we need, like, any founder in any business needs to raise millions in venture. Yeah. They don't, right? So you work with what you have got. And if you identify gaps in what you need, then you figure out the quickest path to actually closing that gap.
So it turns out Mike and I had a whole lot of stuff to talk about. So we're going to split this into two episodes. Catch part two next week.